ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
We did try to stay weekly, but global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
And now we're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming, weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and on the ABC Listen app.
Who doesn't love a good spy thriller? The intrigue, the plot twists, the always slightly flawed sleuth. But how close to the facts is what we see on our screens and read in fiction?
What you see in movies comes from somewhere. Yes, it does happen to jump out of a plane by night. It does happen. But it's not every day James Bond style. You know, it's once in your whole career. You know, I've been seen from my eyes in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of all the commercial planes flying, the plane with all the lights off, opening the back of the plane and dropping some jet skis and dropping some Defenders, four-wheel drive, in the middle of all the commercial planes flying and then jumping after.
You did that?
Yeah. The human intelligence is the key, and the more you go into the technologies, especially now with the biometric system, you have your false identity, but you only have 10 fingers. You know? How do you get into a country when actually, if you go through the border force, but it's the same prince, but different name, you're going to have the alarm bells, you know, all around. So you can't. So you have to enter the country clandestinely. Means jumping.
Jack Beaumont, a pseudonym because he is a former operative of the French Foreign Secret Service, the DGSE. Yes, move over James Bond, move over Sandra Oh's Eve. Today we've got a real-life spy for you. Hey, Natasha Mitchell, joining you for ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, our live event show. Jack Beaumont's first autobiography, The Frenchman, quickly became a bestseller. His latest is called Dark Arena. And he's joining espionage expert and blockbuster British author and columnist Ben McIntyre today, whose many books include The Siege, Agent Sonia, The Spy and the Traitor. And this is Spies, Lies and Secrets, recorded live at the Sydney Writers' Festival and hosted by the acclaimed Australian writer and journalist Matthew Condon.
So I'm going to start, yeah, I don't know heaps about spies, apart from what I've read, but it seems to me that a spy who has the fact that they're a spy in their author bio is a very bad spy. Is that fair, Jack? How can you tell us that you've done it? Surely you're not allowed to.
No, actually, I'm a very bad spy, but at least I'm a spy.
That's true.
Actually, you know, the rule is that the best lie has 80% of truth in it. And so there is no point, you know, hiding yourself of having been in the Secret Service. It's better to say, yes, I was in the DGSE, but not to tell what you did exactly in the services.
Right. So my follow-up question, what did you do in the... No, no.
Read my
books. I understand there's necessary boundaries there. I am interested in the decision to leave and the relationship between that decision and ultimately the decision to start writing books. And I'd love you to make that link for us. Take us there.
Well, you have different kind of intelligence in the intelligence world. And one of them is what we call the dark intelligence, which is very offensive. And that's what the operational division is doing. So all the clandestine operations with the illegal stuff. And those actions, and people don't realize this, but because actually 90% of us are married with kids, because believe it or not, wedding is a sign of mental stability. So we are married with kids and playing different on different identities. So I had 5 different identities all the time on which I was turning. And each time I was finishing a mission using that identity, I was destroying, dismantling that identity to recreate a 5th one. And playing that game every day has a very heavy psychological toll. not only on yourself, but also on the family, on your wife, and of course, on the kids. You end up totally isolated, with no friends, with no one to talk to. And you go away, do your stuff, and your wife is by herself, can't talk to anyone. You reach a very, very high level of paranoia. Everyone is an enemy because there is no Sundays or weekends or holidays, you know? Because the bad guys you are fighting against, they're not going to stop hunting you because it's Sunday. So it just never ends. So I did almost 8 years on the field. So imagine having done 8 years of war mission nonstop with no break. So it's pretty intense for the brain and pretty intense for the family. So the decision was taken to leave because you reach that tipping point where you know that if you stay, you're going to stay forever, but you're going to lose the rest of your private life. So I made the decision to leave also because doing that job, you see the worst of humanity because you have to approach people, enter someone's life, recruit someone, manipulate someone. And usually they are not very nice people. And so you see people abandoning wife and kids to death for money. You see, I mean, lots of different things. So you really see the worst of humanity, but not only into the others. You see the worst of humanity also into yourself, because to fight those people, you have to go down at the same level. And in your yin and yang, you end up having, you know, the white spot almost disappearing, and you know it's time to leave. So I left. So everything was fine. It was a good decision, good for the family and good for my brain and good for my life. And very quickly, of course, you have some, you know, memoirs and nightmares coming up at night. You start having some, you know, bad dreams and memories, and you have a glass of wine and you go, you know, deep down, this kind of stuff with very dark thoughts. And a friend of mine said to me, oh, you should write it down. You should just put it on paper. And that's how I started to write, thinking that no one was going to read it, basically. It was just a self, you know, preservation and cathartic process to unload my soul on the paper. And that's why the main character actually is myself, married with two kids. It's not only an ego trip. And so, that's why this main character is myself. And it worked. It worked really, really well for the first book. And then I got tricked by my own game. Is because it became a bestseller, I had to talk a lot about it. And so each time I talk about it, then it takes me a few days to recover.
Yeah, yeah. I can only imagine. I mean, I must say, isolated, lonely, no friends, paranoid, you fit right in with the writers. I mean, that is the writing community at large. You're well equipped to find some allies there. Ben, I want to ask for you, what was the moment you went, because clearly you're a man pretty deep down a rabbit hole now in terms of your knowledge, your expertise, your fascination with the security services. Was it ever thus, or?
Well, no, well, I was also recruited by British intelligence, by MI6, and it was a classic spy recruitment. I was still at Cambridge and I was actually tapped on the shoulder by one of my tutors, who said there are parts of the Foreign Office that are different from the other parts of the Foreign. He never actually said what I was going to do. And we took one look. I went to the interviews and so on, and they looked at me and I looked at them, and they realised immediately, as I've just demonstrated by not being able to keep a secret, I would have made the world's worst spy. I mean, they had me bang to rights immediately. But writing about non-fiction espionage is a wonderful way, if you have the right material, to write about the sorts of subjects that novelists write about. Loyalty, love, adventure, betrayal, romance. And if there's enough material in the true spy stories, and it works, you can sort of tell a story that feels like a novel, but it's nonetheless completely different. And it's, as Jack has just said, the human motivations of espionage are so complicated. The ends frequently justify the means, but not always. Often espionage, oddly, makes no difference. It doesn't change the world in substantial ways. But sometimes it really does. And when it does, it can be an extraordinary transforming moment. I mean, but what fascinated me about it is the sort of the interior life of these people. What makes people want to enter this dark and complicated and morally fraught universe? And there's an old acronym that is used, still used by the intelligence services. It's a bit of a simplification, but it's MICE. M-I-C-E. And that stands for money, ideology, coercion, and ego. Those are elementally the four elements. And they're always, almost always, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Jack, they're almost always there in some combination. Not always money. Some people reject the money completely, but when you're recruiting an agent, you want to pay them. That is a very good way of hooking them in. Ideology, I never came across a spy that didn't at least claim that they were doing it for a higher purpose, that there was some overarching moral reason for doing what they're doing. Even if it wasn't true, that coercion can come in all sorts of different forms. Blackmail, money problems, sexual difficulties, all those things. But actually, the one strand that runs through all of them is ego, I think. That spies, I'm not really talking about intelligence officers so much here, but the agents that are the stuff of foreign espionage. Ego, there's a sort of hubristic element to almost all of them. And trying to tease out those different elements has been, well, I guess that's the sort of basis of why I find it utterly fascinating.
And when you have no mice, actually, when we do what we call the environment, so basically life check to identify these mice, and there is none. Because the guy is, you know, a nice person, married, kids, happily married, everything's fine. Actually, we're going to, on purpose, destabilize his life to create the mice.
Right. And also, if he's got no rough edges or she's got no rough edges at all, the alarm bells start to go off because they're too perfect. There's a reason why they've smoothed all the edges off.
But as you say, you're so scared of both of you right now. Just without a doubt. I think, Jack, to your point, that thing about destabilizing, that thing about manipulation is where the coercion part of the mice equation comes from. There's an extent to which espionage is people being instrumentalized in the interests of the organization, the company, whatever it is. That seems fascinating to me and potentially fraught, because even if the ends justify the means sometimes, the times that they don't, how do you have faith in an institution like that that is as hard to pin down?
You mean an institution like the French services?
So like the one you were in, yeah.
It's very hard because actually the way it works is when you're working on a mission, on a specific mission, you on purpose only know one piece of the puzzle. And you don't have the full picture because if you get caught or something, you know, you can't tell the whole story. And sometimes you're very proud, you know, bringing back on the high risks your little piece of the puzzle. And you know that it's going straight to the prime minister, to the president, you know, it's kind of top level. And then you sit somewhere in a pub and you watch TV and you see the news and you see that your country is taking just the opposite direction of what you've been bringing back. Mm. So it was totally disregarded. Or the decision was, yeah, there must be somewhere, you know, a higher purpose which beats the one you just demonstrated. Then you think, why making me do this and taking those risks if there is nothing behind? Right? What's the point? Ruining those people's lives for, at the end of the day, not listening. So, but you don't know where exactly the decision is taken. So it's hard to have confidence in your own service. It's very hard. And for the internal molds or people being recruited internally or this kind of stuff, we are very badly paid, clearly. So especially in the French services, you replace the Aston Martin by a Peugeot. but of course, it's an ideal leverage for someone outside to recruit someone, a mole inside the services. The issue with the coercion leverage is that usually people you are trying to recruit with coercion, the first thing they're going to try to do is to get out of it, to escape from it. So it's really short-term manipulation with the coercion because they're going to find a way to bail out. Ideology usually works very, very long time.
Harder to find these days.
Harder to find.
I mean, in the Cold War, there was a clear ideological split. Recruiting people on the other side of the divide was, in a way, a sort of more straightforward job. And again, during the war, that was also a kind of a fairly clear ideological division. And recruiting people to spy against the Nazis, recruiting them to spy against the communist regime, that had a simplicity. These days, it's much more complicated. Where the ideological lines fall is far harder to identify, and therefore far harder to trust the people that you're bringing in. And intelligence that is obtained that way is a dangerous substance in lots of ways, because secret intelligence by governments is often given a prominence and an importance because it is secret, not necessarily because it's true. Secret intelligence is not necessarily any more accurate than open source intelligence. It just happens to have been obtained secretly, or appears to be. So you get a situation, and I'm sure Jack is familiar with these, where governments will sort of order up intelligence. That they will give a pretty clear brief to the intelligence services about what they want. That's really dangerous. I mean, and we saw it during the Iraq War.
Well, I was going to say, can you show me where the weapons of mass destruction are?
Right. And so, but this is classic. I mean, usually this happens in authoritarian regimes, that the boss has a very clear idea of what they want and what they believe to be the case. So Hitler is a very good example. Hitler was absolutely convinced that the D-Day landings were going to take place in Calais.
Yep.
And so enormous effort was made by the intelligence services of all kinds, all the Allied services, really, to prove that to be the case, to reinforce what his expectations already were. And so in a way, that's a classic example of sort of feeding somebody what they wanted. But the KGB, in another way, became absolutely obsessed in the early 80s with the idea that there was going to be a first strike, that the West was planning a nuclear first strike on Moscow. And orders went out to all the KGB stations, it was called Operation Rian, around the world, saying, there's going to be a first strike, find evidence. And sure enough, the KGB went out and found evidence. I mean, some of it completely mad. I mean, you know, if the lights were left on in the Defence Ministry in Canberra overnight, it was assumed that was a sign they were getting ready for nuclear war. So everything they were looking for kind of fed the preconceptions. So there are real dangers inherent in the whole idea of intelligence.
Blockbuster, British author of many a spy story, columnist Ben McIntyre, with former French intelligence officer and author Jack Beaumont. Australian writer and journalist Matthew Condon is hosting this terrific conversation on spies, lies and secrets, recorded live at the Sydney Writers' Festival. And this is ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. It's great to have you on board. I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can find all our episodes on the ABC Listen app. It's your one-stop spot for all ABC podcasts. Just search for Big Ideas. Now, for these espionage insiders, how close to the truth are the antics of fictional spies and traitors?
What's your sense, having studied, having written about so many different intelligence services, so many different agencies, in terms of the culture within them and its relationship with the government of the day? Are they servants of a political agenda, or do they transcend that? Are they somehow running a different, longer game that isn't swept up in the vicissitudes of their political masters?
They have to be, I think, is the short answer. They have to have a much longer horizon than the immediate government of the day, because otherwise you would have all sorts of problems inside intelligence services if they felt that the political complexion of the masters was not suiting them. No, they're civil servants, so they have... serve the country. Yeah. In my experience, they tend to be people who have a sort of fairly rock-ribbed sense of patriotism and serving the country rather than the government, that what they're doing is a wider cause. Mm. Of course, within that, that requires ideological affinity as well. You know, if you were fighting the Cold War, but actually you were a secret communist, that was going to be quite hard to do. There were one or two, actually. There were also communist spies inside British intelligence. But so I think on the whole, it's the longer horizon.
Well, there's a funny story on that. It's every French president, newly elected, one of the first thing they do is to come at the headquarters of the DGSE and ask to see their file on them.
Yep.
So before any elections, all the candidates' files are put under another name, a false name.
Amazing.
And so you have the election, the winner comes, ask for his file. Of course, there is nothing, so he's very happy. Dash off. And then the file goes back to his name.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. That's divine. I love that. That's fantastic. Now, you are going to get to ask questions of these two. I will note that for very real, very considered reasons, both of them have a strong preference not to be asked questions about specific geopolitical movements, moments, whatever. We need to keep the conversation at either the literary or at the broader level where possible. So if you do ask a question about, tell me, Jack, where were you on this day at this place during this conflict, we won't be answering it. I'll be answering it, but I don't know, so it won't be that helpful. So I mentioned that. Feel free to send them in any time, and I'm going to take one straight away for you, Jack, asking how you developed The Frenchman from an initial idea to a novel. What were the practicalities? Did you travel back to the places that were in the book? Did you, or was it from memory, slightly twisted through the lens of fiction?
I cheated. I cheated because it's basically based on a real mission. So I knew exactly the whole, storyline. I knew exactly where it was starting and where it was ending. And then I decided to, of course, change the name of the people, name of the countries, and, change all the locations and everything. And to add a few anecdotes on the way. So I knew exactly where I was in that story and where I was going. So it was kind of easy. And then in terms of remembering, what people usually underestimate is the intelligence. We were discussing this just before. Everything, and that's the strength of a service, is its memory. And to have that memory, you need to document everything. So when you come back from the field, each time you do the smallest thing on the field, you have to write it down. You have to write. So you spend a massive amount of time writing. And writing like a novelist and at the third person, because you mustn't be identified as the writer, and describing the colors, the smells, this and that, all the details. Because you write them down once, you usually remember very well, what happened.
Jack is part of a long and very distinguished literary tradition of spies who then become novelists.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the great English novelists of the 20th century, a very large proportion of them have been spies. John le Carré, Somerset Maugham, Ian Fleming, Graham Greene.
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah. But, and I think there's a reason for that, and I'd love to know if Jack agrees. It's sort of because spying is also an act of the imagination. I mean, to be an intelligence officer and to be an agent requires you to create an imaginary world and to live in it and to inhabit it and to persuade others that it's real. That's a pretty good definition of fiction. That's what novelists...
And schizophrenia.
That's right.
It does baffle me, though. I mean, the part of it I can't get my head around is it sounds like the opening to a spy story. A former spy decides to write a novelized version of the events they were involved with and, the agency has to come after them to silence them. Did you have to go to your former employers and get approval to share these stories, to put this on the page?
So I had to have a few discussions with them. Basically, you have two different kinds of former spy decide to write. They decide to write some autobiography and I did this and I did that. And that's a very bad idea.
I think it's a great idea.
That's a very bad idea because, as I was saying before, as you only know usually one piece of the puzzle, by doing so, even sometimes without knowing it, you put in danger the rest of the whole operation. So you might have some people still in the field, still recruiting or already still recruited and still, betraying their country and their company. And by telling that story to the open world, then you're going to put those people in danger. And it does happen that those people get killed because you've been talking a bit too much. So that was clearly not the intent for me, not only because I don't want to go to jail, but because the purpose for me was to describe this psychological aspect, which is rarely described in TV series, in movies, in books, that you have to be a spy with those five different names, and then you come back home, and actually you end up with your real identity being a sixth identity. And you have your kids going like, "Daddy," when a few hours before you were doing something which was very borderline, and you have to teach them how to be honest and, you know, and all those values and stuff. So
I feel bad when I go and have a sneaky cigarette in the backyard and then go into my kids. Yeah. So I can't even imagine.
That's roughly the same.
Both ethical grey areas, I think, is the thing.
So, yeah. So
but that's fear of unexpected consequences of, you know, of what you run the risk of exposing unwittingly when you share these stories. I mean, you must have come across that more than once. Even though the books you're writing are more historical, I have no doubt, Ben, there would be moments where a source or someone says to you, "Oh, please don't share that."
Fewer than you would think, actually. I mean, spies actually love telling their stories, and they are tremendously indiscreet when they get the opportunity. I don't think with mine, because of the historical gap, I mean, a lot of what I do is based on declassified material. So MI5 began declassifying its files in the early 90s. That's the interior, that's the security service, our internal security service. So a lot of my stuff comes from those. And just to illustrate what Jack was saying, they are wonderfully written. I mean, these are often written by people who are sort of, in a way, frustrated writers, and they put their souls into this stuff. And those files are particularly glorious because they're secret. They're never meant to be read outside the sort of secret circle. And so they're kind of honest in a way that most government files aren't. So when it goes wrong, they are writing in the margin, "We're completely screwed here. You know, and I hate Gladys down the hall, and, you know, he's fiddling his expenses, that one." So you get the kind of real warp and weft of a thing sort of unveiling in front of you. And there have been times when I've wondered whether I am sort of exposing people's private worlds, definitely. But I think you feel that as a biographer of any sort, whether you are sort of exposing people's private moments. I've never had a situation where the intelligence services has tried to stop me. That may come, but it's only may come with my new one. But on the whole, they are keen to have their stories told in a real way. The mythologizing of this world is so intense. The James Bonding of what is done in this world is sort of almost unstoppable. And indeed, the intelligence services are very prey to it themselves. I mean, there's an awful lot. If you look at the MI6 website, there's an awful lot of stuff about, this is not really about James Bond, you know, but they can't stop themselves from continually referring to James Bond. So I think they actually do quite like it when there are stories that tell the real sort of warp and weft of that world.
Presumably, not to suddenly become paranoid myself, but that's not just about telling the true stories. That's about, sometimes that mythologizing is about propaganda, or it's about obscuring the true stories, that if you can normalize something. We were talking backstage that there's a story that does the rounds that when the first series of the Fox TV show 24 came out, there were writers on the team who were from the CIA whose express purpose was to write in activities to normalize them with the American public. So if they saw a CIA agent in the show torturing a suspect, that would be normalized and it would feel a bit more okay because they'd seen it on the telly. That by turning this into story, it bought them the cover they required to do what they wanted to do, which seems frighteningly plausible to me.
I think it is. I mean, you know, active measures is probably what would come under that broad title, are attempts by all governments to frame public opinion. Sometimes they are more overt and malign than others, but that's absolutely part of, I mean, propaganda, black propaganda, white propaganda, it's all central to espionage. It goes on all the time.
Well, there is a question from the audience for you, Ben, related to that, which is, when you're interviewing spies, former, current, how do you trust what they say?
Well, of course.
How do you know that they're not just using you?
It's a very good question, and I don't, obviously. I mean, I can't be sure that I'm not being thrown a line. Usually when I'm doing a story that is still alive in living memory like that. So I did a book about a double agent called Oleg Gordievsky, who was a KGB officer who'd spied for the West for 10 years, an extraordinary man. He died very recently. In that case, I was able to interview all the MI6 officers who had run him. And I interviewed them separately. And their stories elided, stories is the wrong word, their memories elided in a way that was very remarkable, actually. And I thought it was something to do with the training, actually. I think it's, again, what you were talking about, the way that everything has to be written down. So it is already, in a way, inscribed in their memories because they've actually put it to paper. But it was astonishing how very closely those stories align. Now, if they hadn't, I would have begun to smell a rat and thought, well, somebody's off, somebody's not on the main page here. But that often doesn't happen when you're interviewing a living witness because, and this is slightly off the point, but memory is such a, it's such a difficult thing to pin down. And we all think that our memories are truth. We all think that, that if I recollect something and I tell you what happened, that I am the only author of the knowledge of whether that's true or not. And of course it isn't. Because memory is not the same as truth. Memory is, memories are the narratives that we tell ourselves. And the more we tell them, the more we tend to embellish them, the better reception they get, the more likely we are to maintain that embellishment. It's often, I think, why people have siblings, really. It's they're there to say, that story you just told was complete nonsense. You know, it wasn't like that at all. But so, but you, the answer is, you can't be absolutely sure. And you know, when you're relying on oral testimony, on living witnesses, often of events that have taken place a very, very long time ago, you can't completely trust them. But a final point on that is that often I'm asking them about the most important thing that ever happened to them. That the single most important case they ran, or in Oleg's case, I interviewed him for 140 hours in the end. That's that. Those events that he was describing are absolutely engraved on his memory. So often he would be much better at remembering those than he could remember what he'd had for breakfast.
Jack, I'm curious about the process of creating the character of Alec and fleshing him out to be distinct from you, but to tell the kind of story that you wanted to tell. Seems to me one of the tropes in spy fiction, in storytelling about espionage, is about hyper-competence. You know, it's about the person who you can drop into any situation and they know just what to do. They know how to read the room. In fact, it's that very concept that Mick Herron plays with in his Slow Horses books of here are the incompetence of the spies, here are the people who can't get it right every time. And I'm, to paraphrase Liam Neeson, a particular set of skills that you're sketching out for your character that you yourself held. How do you avoid accidentally showing spycraft that is kind of insider secrets, is the kind of the doing of the job rather than the bigger bit?
Well, I think there is, the spycraft I described in my books, I mean, there is much more than that that I know of, but I limited myself to what was, I made sure that everything was already in open sources, what I was saying, so that I had no issue with my former employer. But the way, it's good to know, for someone who doesn't know that world, that you have this spycraft, but if you don't know how to use it, like for example, when we are in other places, we communicate with little stickers that we put in different places, which means different things, because we have no phone, no card, no, you know, we don't communicate like that. So it's really like clandestine, and actually comes from the resistance during the Second World War. Methodology, so really purely clandestine operation stuff.
The real life of a spy. This is a former French intelligence officer, Jack Beaumont. His books include The Frenchman and Dark Arena. Ben McIntyre's latest book is called The Siege. And this conversation from the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival is hosted by journalist Matthew Condon. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Natasha Mitchell. And in this digital era, does the famous park bench scene still have a role in the exchange of clandestine information?
Sorry, can I just check? Is it a recurring feature that a lot of that stuff is analog? That in this kind of digital age, good spycraft
is actually the more... The more it becomes digital, the more you have to go back to old methodologies.
Have you ever sat on a park bench and put your briefcase down and someone sat beside you and they picked it up? Yeah. See, that's good. Yeah. That's what I want to know.
Yeah, of course. No, it's really the old stuff. It's important to understand that there is a dimension of course, budget of the services and size of the services. So to give you a rough idea, DGSE, let's say it's around 10,000 people, like the SIS or MI6. Right? The Russian services, so former KGB was split in different services. So you have the FSB, the SVR, and the GRU. So the GRU is the military branch of foreign intelligence. GRU is around 20,000. Then you have the SVR, which is the Foreign Civil Service. It's around 35,000. Then you have the FSB, which is 320,000, right? Give you an idea.
Yeah.
Then you have the Chinese, the MSS, 1.2 million.
Huge, yeah.
So when you have this kind of gaps in terms of numbers, you don't have the same methodologies. And so typically the US made the mistake. At that time, it was not seen as a mistake, but to focus after the Second World War on all the signal intelligence, so interceptions with the Echelon program, so intercepting all the communication. But at that time, you had, you know, the fixed line and people were talking on the phone. But now, with the mobile phones, they intercept 2 million communications per second. How can you analyze 2 million communications per second? So what they did is they did put some keywords. Right? So if you say Al-Qaeda, you have 10 seconds before, 10 seconds after recorded. But of course, the people of Al-Qaeda, they are not saying Al-Qaeda.
No.
They are saying, let's catch up tomorrow, like the usual place, you know.
Yeah.
And so we, because we didn't have the budget of CIA, we had to keep a very strong knowledge and skills into the human intelligence. I'm not saying that it's cheaper, because you have to sometimes pay some people a lot of money. But we kept that knowledge. And actually, we realize today that CIA has a real lack of knowledge in human intelligence, not only because when you see a 6'4" black guy like this with no neck, with trekking shoes in the middle of Peshawar, you know he's CIA. but it's different methodologies. And those skills, to go back to your question, those skills, you learn a lot of them, but you don't use them all the time. But what you see in movies comes from somewhere. Yes, it does happen to jump out of a plane by night. It does happen. But it's not every day James Bond style. You know, it's once in your whole career. You know, I've been seen from my eyes in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of all the commercial planes flying, the plane with all the lights off, opening the, you know, the back of the plane and dropping some jet skis and dropping some Defenders, four-wheel drive, in the middle of all the commercial planes flying and then jumping after.
You did that.
Yeah.
But only once, so you're kind of weak.
Yeah. No, but I mean, what I'm saying is that it's not James Bond in the sense that what James Bond is doing is actually done by 150 people. But the human intelligence is the key. And the more you go into the technologies, especially now with the biometric system, so you know when you go into a country and you have to put your fingers and everything, you have your false identity, but you only have 10 fingers. You know? So how do you get into a country when actually if you go through the border force, but it's the same prince, but different name, you're gonna have the alarm bells, you know, all around. So you can't. So you have to enter the country clandestinely. It means jumping.
Or have you tried a newspaper with eye holes in it? And you kind of go along and they can't. I've seen that and I think it's quite compelling.
Yeah. But there is an assumption, you're absolutely right, that sort of the digital revolution has somehow so transformed the espionage landscape that it's really all about texts and emails and so on. But actually that makes, as you've just said, human intelligence is as important, if not more important than it's ever been. Because while you may know that you're target is on his mobile phone in Raqqa at a particular point, you need to have a human being who has eyes on him, who can tell you that it's actually him and he's actually in that particular cafe. So the human intelligence is vital and it is becoming more analog. I mean, a lot of the services now don't use digital communications for really Absolutely. Important stuff. They use bits of paper. You know, they've gone back to, I mean, old typewriters. You know, because if you're typing it like that, it can be picked up. So, you know, funnily enough, it's all sort of in a way getting more retrogressive because you can falsify digitally, just as you can in any other way. I mean, there's a whole department of GCHQ in Britain, the sort of communications centre, that is dedicated to teaching agents and officers how to create false identities online. It's called Operation Mincemeat, rather flatteringly. And it's about how you create a false person, how you make an avatar, because if you're going to pretend to be somebody, you have to have an Instagram account, you have to have a past, you have to have a proper digital legend that will convince anybody who's doing an idle Google search that you are actually who you are when you're actually not.
Yeah. I have a friend who's not well, but who has a fake finger that he wears in photos so that it scans as AI when people see it. When there's 11 fingers, that's one of the signs that the photo's not to be trusted. And I think he's crazy, but also maybe he's smart.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I love it.
This all mystifies me and worries me. Ben, I want to make sure before we get out of here, you did allude to the fact that the book you're working on at the moment might be the one that has the security services coming and knocking on your door and saying, no.
I'm not sure how they could say no, because I'm not an officer. I'm not part of the organisation. I mean, it's an interesting story, and it sort of illustrates what we were talking about earlier, which is that humans, agents and officers, are human beings. They have all the same ordinary frailties and humane or humanitarian instincts or whatever. They're just normal people, actually. They just happen to be in slightly abnormal jobs. My new book is a very, very strange story of a Russian KGB officer recruited in post-revolutionary Iran. So it's at the time when the Ayatollah is trying to get full control of the country. He hasn't got it yet because the Communist Party is still running in Iran. And this character, who was called Vladimir Kuzitskin, was 6'4", was a huge Russian. And he came over to the West. Well, he didn't come over, he came over in the end, but he was recruited by MI6. But it swiftly transpired that his reason for doing this was not ideology, it wasn't coercion, definitely wasn't money, and it wasn't ego. It was because, wait for it, he suffered from erectile dysfunction and believed that the West had medicines that would cure it, which they did not, because Viagra hadn't been invented and wouldn't be invented for another 14 years, but they pretended they did.
I have to say, it's very rare for spies to have this kind of issue.
It is rare. It's not a problem that afflicts James Bond ever. I mean, I think I did a tot-up of all the conquests.
I may have read Dr. No slightly differently, but yeah. I think that's...
There you go. But, I mean, had not had this particular affliction, we would be living in a different world.
God.
So I love the fact that it's a very small, private problem for this one particular individual ends up having these extraordinary ramifications. That's when espionage, I think, becomes truly fascinating.
Have you been able to resist giving it a name that's a terrible pun? Because I would recommend Hard Intelligence.
I like it.
Or Soft Power, by the one.
I like it. My problem is that his code name was Redwood. It actually really was, and that wasn't intended to be a joke, because he got that before the problem revealed. So, yeah, I don't know quite what I'm going to do about that.
Yeah. Once again, fiction is not equal to it. You need non-fiction to tell the story. We have a question here from Ed in the audience for you, Jack, asking whether there were occasions when you had to compromise your own personal values as a spy and how you managed to navigate that.
Every day. Almost every day. That's the whole point of the intelligence. Basically, when you try to recruit a human source, it's because you want to get the intelligence in that person's mind. You have a few options there. Either this person is not aware that he or she got this information in his mind, or this person is trained to protect it. And sometimes there are good people and sometimes there are bad people. So if it's a bad Russian or a bad Iranian or terrorists trained to protect this information, you're going to have to do certain things to get this information, because he won't give it easily. So you have, as I was saying before, you have to go yourself quite deep in the darknesses to be able to get that information. When it's someone who is not trained, it's kind of easier to obtain it. But it's worse because you do the trick to someone who is nice. And knowing that from the moment you recruit someone, it's never very, very rare occasions, but never going to end up well for this person. Because from the moment you have the intelligence, you don't want anyone else to know that you have it, to know what it is, and anyone else to get it as well. So basically, this person has to disappear. So it's violent. When it's on violent and mean people, you know, you accept it. But when it's nice people, and that's the beginning of my first book, The Frenchman. He was a dad, married with a kid, a young kid, and the leverage was a new life for him and his family, so a kind of ideology / money. And there was a leak somewhere, we don't know where, but basically the services of the country got to the wife's house, got the mom and the dad, so his in-laws, and with a gun on their head, forced them to call the wife to say, your dad is very sick, you should come back home immediately. So she believed it, because it was sincere from the mom. So she flew back with the kid, of course arrested at the border. And then she, with a gun on the head, had to call the husband with who I was meeting, saying, you have to come back immediately because my dad is very sick. And when I left him for the first, on that day, he turned around and looked at me and he said farewell instead of saying goodbye. So I understood there was something wrong. But he was, for the last 2 years, showing me pictures of his kid, everything. He was a really nice person, very clever, everything. But he was giving us some critical information on some very specific type of missile. And he got arrested at the border, and he was taken in a basement where his wife and his kid were strapped on the chair, and those local services of this country started with a driller on the kid. And then, of course, he said everything about how to contact me, where to find me, etc., what was my name and everything. So I came back, I went on another mission, and a few weeks after, we had the intelligence that this did happen. And I said to my boss, I said, oh, what do? I dismantle my ID immediately. And he said, no, because we mustn't burn the other source we have on the other side, thanks to who we have this information. So they're going to contact you pretending it's him, because he talked and he said everything before dying. And you're going to have to go to the meeting, because otherwise we burn the other source. And so I had to go to a meeting with a dead man, basically, and jump in the trap, knowing it was a trap, not to burn the other source. It's very, intelligence is not, you know, white and black. It's very blurry. It's very muddy. And sometimes they are really good people. And for superior interest, or at least you hope it's for superior interest, you have to do certain things. And no, you don't live well with it. And that's why you end up writing novels.
I mean, that's a very graphic illustration of, in a way, the heart of the moral problem, which is that intelligence services around the world are recruiting the citizens of other countries to betray those countries. And they may be wicked regimes, they may deserve to be betrayed, but at its essence, it can be a manipulative relationship that is about getting people to do things that are not in their best interests. Mm.
Is it a system, an approach to the world that, for both of you, that you can reconcile? Or the more you know about it, the more you read about it, the harder is it to see it as something justifiable?
At its best, I think intelligence can be a noble profession, and it can change the world in dramatically important ways. So there are a few very good examples of this. The Bletchley Park intercepts in the Second World War that picked up all the Enigma coding stuff that was being done. Now, that probably shortened the war by something between 18 months and 2 years. It saved an enormous number of lives. And that was based on human intelligence, in essence. The core of that was not a signals intelligence. I mean, the breaking of the codes was signals intelligence. But the obtaining of the Enigma machines, that was a proper piece of spycraft. So there are occasions when it really does work. Oleg Gordievsky is another good one. His intelligence actually shortened the Cold War. I mean, it was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. He managed to convince the West that the rhetoric about the evil empire was actually just creating everything, making everything much worse. So there are occasions when it really does matter. Operation Mincemeat's another one.
Saved hundreds or thousands of lives.
Yeah, absolutely. By convincing the Germans using a dead body equipped with false papers that the assault on Europe from Africa was going to land in Greece and Sardinia and not in Sicily. And that saved thousands of lives. Mm. So sometimes it is critically important, but not always. And beneath all of these stories, there are sort of ordinary humans struggling to work out what to do in very fraught circumstances over which they have no control. That's the other side of espionage. It's not the jumping out of planes, and it's not the sort of almighty, effective kind of intelligence machine that we sort of imagine. Underneath it all are perfectly ordinary people stuck in very, very difficult situations.
Jack, what about for you? The toll, the personal toll is obviously a huge one. Hearing you talk, I am struck by the deep, lasting damage and trauma that you have to navigate. And I'm very pleased for you. I'm very pleased for your family that you found, you were able to call time on it. You were able to find a way out, and you were able to find a way to channel it into something not just productive, but also that is immensely gratifying for readers everywhere. You know, it's a good thing. But too big a cost?
I think writing really helped me, but talking about it doesn't always help. I've got this fantastic gym around the corner of my house called the Blast Pit, where my mate Nick has some ice bath. And so almost every morning I do some ice bath, which are generally around 3 or 4 degrees. And you spend like 5 minutes in it. Despite the writing, last year I was in a bad space. And I think that doing this every morning really helped me psychologically. It's like if you were, you know, someone who never did any scuba diving. You look at the ocean and you see the horizon, the sun, and, you know, the boats on surface. But if you did some scuba diving only once and you've seen what is under, you can't look at the ocean without thinking, what's under? Huh? And that's the problem with the intelligence people, or people who've worked in the intelligence sphere, is that you see the worst in everything. You can't just enjoy the present moment and be in the moment, because you're always anticipating, where is the threat? What's behind? You know, someone comes and talks to you in a dinner. What does he want? Why? What's behind that, you know? Someone in the street, a car, a bike, whatever. So always on high alert. And that's very, very tiring for you, but also for the people living with you.
I think if the writing is helpful, if the ice baths are helpful, if the talking about it isn't always helpful, but I'd ask you to join me in thanking Ben and Jack.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Coming to you from the stage of the Sydney Writers' Festival, Spies, Lies and Secrets, Jack Beaumont is author of The Frenchman and Dark Arena. He's a former operative with the French Foreign Secret Service, the DGSC. And you also heard from the best-selling author Ben McIntyre. His latest book, The Siege, goes inside the extraordinary televised SAS storming of the Iranian embassy in London back in 1980. The host was the prize-winning journalist and author Matthew Condon. He writes novels, he writes true crime stories. And thank you to the Sydney Writers' Festival team. You can hear all Big Ideas episodes, 4 fantastic live events with big thinkers land every week from our team. This is your front row seat to the best festivals, the best talks, debates, the whole lot. And if you'd like to join me at an upcoming event, you can head to the Big Ideas homepage. Just scroll to the bottom, look for Be In Our Audience. We love hearing from you. BigIdeas@abc.net.au. Email us. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.